And Bigfoot represents possibilities, says something positive about our wilderness. If a creature like that could exist in these landscapes, and maybe we haven't destroyed them quite so thoroughly. Maybe there's some hope for the American landscape.
John O'Connor is a journalist and author of one of my favorite books of the year, The Secret History of Bigfoot, Field Notes on a North American Monster, which is an investigation into the king of all cryptids, but even more so, into what this elusive being means to those who seek proof of its existence. John spent a year traveling the country, meeting, talking to, and camping with all kinds of Bigfooters to get to the heart of why a new Bigfoot craze has swelled up in recent years, looking at the phenomenon through a lens of psychology, sociology, politics, science, history, and through the writings of those who have meditated on the question of belief itself. Today, John and I talk about the different types of Bigfoot believers and skeptics, how the fantastical arena of politics we find ourselves in today has allowed this story to take on new life, and why Bigfoot matters to those who spend their lives chasing this mythical beast. I'm your host, Chelsea Weber Smith, and this is American Hysteria. Hi, John. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
You know, I have to say that I have been reading your book, and it's not only so interesting, kind of the information that you've gathered and the interviews that you've done, but it's just like kind of a beautiful on the road in America book, which is one of my favorite genres. So I just want people to know this is like a beautifully written book with so much heart. And I don't know, I just absolutely loved it. So thank you for writing it.
Oh, well, thanks for saying that. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, that was part of the, you know, one of the things I really wanted to do after COVID, as I'm sure probably everyone did, was just get on the road and see this, you know, remarkable country of ours, and just see landscapes that I hadn't seen either in a really long time or hadn't seen before.
Yeah.
So yeah, I haven't talked about it in that way, I don't think, but it is kind of a road trip book.
I mean, I think it's definitely a road trip book, and it, I mean, I got that feeling reading it of like, I got to go back on the road. I spent a lot of months of my life traveling, living in my truck camper, hitchhiking all over. And I think part of what I love so much about your book was the way that you approached kind of the subjects that you met along the way. You really handled each person and their belief system around Bigfoot with like curiosity and tenderness. And I don't know, I just think it's just such a great example of what you can do with a topic like this beyond just, oh, how did this story come to be and what is the history of it? It's so much more your book, I think, a philosophy of why Bigfoot has popped up again and when Bigfoot has popped up in history and what that's kind of meant culturally and politically. And so I would love to just first of all ask you kind of what your relationship was to Bigfoot, both as a being, but also as this subject that you decided to take on in the way that you did.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because it really gestated. I hadn't, to be perfectly honest, had never really given Bigfoot much thought before I started researching this book. And it really began to gestate during the pandemic. And I think that's not a coincidence. I mean, I think Bigfoot, you know, the kind of popular image of Bigfoot anyway, came to embody something for me that I really craved, which was just mystery and adventure and, you know, the unknown. I wanted it to have that feeling of just like, yeah, driving through wide open space. But I didn't have, as a kid, I'm from a small town in the Midwest. I didn't have any particular interest in Bigfoot. Like I did later as an adult, but only with the arrival of this idea to write about Bigfoot and really mostly write about Bigfooters, the people who spent their kind of weekends in the woods looking for a Bigfoot. Yeah, but I found out in a roundabout way that a writer I really loved and admired, and who I write about in the book, named Peter Matheson, was a Bigfoot hunter. That also kind of opened things up for me, I think, and gave me a kind of permission to write about Bigfoot in a way that wasn't prurient and dismissive, but kind of took the belief system serious and took the believers serious. And I wanted to meet them and kind of figure out where they came from, kind of where they were coming from, literally and figuratively, and why they believed what they did.
Yeah, definitely. I've never really been a Bigfoot person either. I feel like what I fall into is ghosts. That's my magical being that I can't quite shake my belief in. So something that really interests me about the Bigfoot phenomenon is the spiritual Bigfoot, which, you know, has a lot of woo, as you refer to it in the book, versus this kind of like ecological Bigfoot that I really liked that those who believe in the spiritual Bigfoot call apers or flesh and blooders, which is a very badass name. So I wanted to just hear about your experiences with both types of believers and if you kind of fall in either of those camps or not. And we can talk more about your personal beliefs later.
Sure. Yeah. The woo thing totally caught me by surprise, man. I had no idea that. And I think that's because that's a fairly recent development. I mean, there is an articulation of it early on in this kind of famous incident in Mount St. Helens, which I write about. But besides that, it, I think, more or less vanished from the culture until pretty recently. But so the flesh and blooder, just so your readers know, there's kind of two different poles of belief. You know, flesh and blooders being those who kind of think that Bigfoot is just a undiscovered hominid species, and wooers who believe there's some other more mystical or paranormal supernatural providence for Bigfoot. There's definitely huge shades of belief between these two poles, but they are kind of the dominant sort of binary ways of understanding belief in Bigfoot. And far and away, it's the biggest school, in my experience, is the flesh and blooders. I mean, and people are familiar with woo ideas and conversant in them, but very few folks that I met will actually cop to a belief in that sort of stuff. You know, they'll entertain ideas, but the flesh and blooders were, at least the folks that I hung out with, were by far the sort of dominant strain of belief in the culture. Yeah, again, I think that has changed maybe a little bit in the last few years, as I understand it. But I think it's starting to be a little bit more wooey as Bigfoot continues to be elusive. You know, a lot of Bigfooters have told me, I should probably qualify that. I don't know about a lot, but a few Bigfooters told me and expressed in other ways that they are, you know, discouraged and dismayed by the lack of hard evidence that, as you know, it's now been 3/4 of a century, basically, since the kind of modern iteration of Bigfoot came out of Northern California and the Pacific Northwest, and there's still no real hard evidence, no body, no bones, no solid photographic or video evidence. And so some, I think woo is a way of explaining that away and kind of making peace with this big question of why there isn't any evidence.
Right, right. And it seems like, and I think this is obviously totally true with conspiracy theories or any kind of fantastical belief system, is that a lot of times it feels like focusing on the scientific side, even if it's very pseudoscientific, makes folks feel more like they can believe in something because it's kind of in that language. Is that something that you found a lot on the road too?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and I just wanted to add to my last comment, many, many Bigfooters would vociferously disagree with me that there's not any evidence. You know, I would just say, as being qualified, I'd say there's not great incontrovertible evidence, you know. Okay. So that would, leading back to your more recent question, it's that would convince scientists. You know, it's not convinced, there's nothing that's going to convince people who aren't already believers, I think, that believe that Bigfoot is real. And, you know, Bigfooters like to say that they are, and I heard this a ton of times, like citizen scientists that practice, they try to follow the scientific method. They do, in a sense, like up to a point, but then they don't really, you know, even scientists get things wrong. You know, like we are generally a science illiterate culture. I am a science illiterate person who barely passed high school chemistry. So I totally sympathize with that, you know, but scientists also struggle with data and collection and data sets. And there's a lot of bad data out there. And there's this guy at Columbia University, this famous cancer researcher, who it turns out a lot of his research is all flawed. You know, there's another woman, I think, at Cornell, who's a social scientist, a psychologist. A lot of her research is totally either flawed or fraudulent, you know, and so it's tough, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of benefactors do like to think they proceed that way, and it validates in their minds their endeavors, but it doesn't validate it, I think, in many other people's minds, because it's not genuine science.
Right.
You know, and there's, of course, Jeff Meldrum, who's, is he an anthropologist or an anatomist, I think, at Idaho State University, and he's one of these. There's always like a bad boy scientist who's sort of thrown his lot in with the Bigfooters. It used to be this guy named Grover Krantz, who's passed away a long time ago, and now it's Jeff Meldrum has kind of picked up his mantle. But he also serves to validate a lot of Bigfooters' beliefs. But his approach, his method, if you ask me, is not scientific.
Sure.
Very often. He's a lovely guy. I don't mean to badmouth him. I've met him a couple of times. I've talked to him a bunch. He really helped me out early on in my book, so I don't mean to besmirch it. Jeff Meldrum was a lovely guy, but yes, the science thing is a really thorny issue among Bigfooters, you know, for obvious reasons.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, and you also talk about this in your book. You know, we start kind of in 1967, the Patterson-Gimlin film, the very, very famous image that everybody thinks of when they think of Bigfoot. I loved how you brought in the fact that this was also kind of the birth of the New Age movement happening in Northern California, where this, you know, thing was allegedly shot. And how do you think historically that big change in kind of what many Americans believed in spiritually, how do you think that affected our idea of this creature that had been around but really kind of exploded in popularity kind of around the same time of this new spiritual movement?
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason it exploded in popularity was just because of the cinema and because of television. You know, American mm-hmm. homes were starting to have TV. We were starting to have access to cinema in a way that we had never had before. So I think that explains a huge part of it. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's some folks out there, this guy David Dangling at the University of Florida, I believe, who really attributes Bigfoot's continued survival today in the public imagination, pins it to the internet. You know, it's just made it easier for us to continue to imagine this creature. And so I really think that had a lot to do with it. In terms of spirituality, I think you're referring to the part of the book where I mentioned the decline of American religion and the decline of church attendance, mm-hmm. and yeah, which has gone down, mm-hmm. down drastically. Yeah, I think that, you know, it's interesting that on the one hand, we have some considerable evidence that our belief in the fantastic, in the untenable, in the unbelievable has greatly diminished. But on the other hand, we have this whole other kind of set of data that indicates the opposite, that we haven't gotten any more rational or any more reasonable, that we've just kind of transferred our willingness to believe to other precincts. And one of those being the kind of legend and lore, American legends that are just passed down, handed down the century to us, and that have a very firm grip on our imaginations.
Yeah. And that sort of feels to me, at least, like pretty inevitable. And I think if we look all over the world, it's like we are creatures of myth. We need something to believe in. We need something kind of more than what's in front of us. And Bigfoot fulfills that role for people. And I believe in your book, you talk about how things like Bigfoot or other types of cryptids or other types of unorthodox beliefs give us a chance to believe in something that's outside of Christianity or mainstream religion. So it kind of provides this alternative to that, that also allows us to actually investigate, whereas I think traditional religion generally avoids that type of questioning. And I thought that was a very interesting and astute point to make. And I was curious about how Did you see that type of phenomenon kind of person to person where they were able to experience some version of belief, but with this caveat that it's not too out there because I'm looking for it in this way and I'm willing to investigate it again and again and again?
Yeah, well, and of course, you know, Bigfoot is the kind of belief that doesn't come with all the judgment, you know, and the fire and brimstone and the guilt. And of course, it depends a lot on who you ask. It's not a totally salient replacement for a religion for a lot of folks. And the two are complementary too for many people. There's not some kind of monolithic set of Bigfooters or belief systems within the culture, in my experience. But yeah, and I think you also, and I tried to be very careful about this, and this was something that I hadn't anticipated when I began this book, is there are really different kinds of belief out there, and all variants of belief, you know, and there's something that psychologists call half belief even, which is the ways in which our sort of stated belief or unbelief in things doesn't align with our behavior. So like, for instance, the famous example, I find in my book a lot of examples of baseball. Baseball's great for so many things. And like, I don't know if you've ever been to like a late inning baseball game where like it's like bottom of the sixth, top of the seventh inning, and the pitcher is throwing a no hitter. And this kind of murmur goes up in the stadium. You can almost, this vibration, you can hear it, you know, because it's a big deal to throw a no hitter, but you're not allowed to talk about it. Like, no one's allowed to say anything. If you say something about it, may very likely get like a beer can thrown at you. You might get chased out of your seat, you know, because you're going to jinx the pitcher, you know? Yeah. So you have this whole stadium full of people who are in their waking lives are normal, lucid, totally reasonable, rational people, but come to believe quite powerfully in the jinx. And, you know, that's kind of a small example, but there's all kinds of examples in our lives, that ways in which we behave that aren't rational at all. And we also have a way of claiming to believe certain things without those beliefs really impinging on our lives in any meaningful way. So people say they believe in Bigfoot, but it's not actually something that they're kind of prepared to position that they're prepared to defend or go to the barricades for, you know. But and we have people who claim to believe in ghosts or claim they don't believe in ghosts. You know, people know what the right answer is there often, but they'll say they have a lot of caveats with that generally. Well, I don't believe in ghosts, but when my great aunt died, I had this experience when I woke up in the middle of the night and she was standing at the end of my bed or something like that, you know. So
totally.
It's hard to put belief into one category, and it's porous. There's a lot of, you know, the boundaries are malleable and moved depending on the believer and depending on what's fashionable, depending on what happens to be on TV, depending on what kind of mood you're in as a speaker. But generally, just to kind of go back to your original question, I do think that their Bigfoot is one of many, many, many kind of new agey / paranormal / supernatural replacements for traditional religious belief.
More after this. You ever notice how finding time and energy to do the most basic human necessity, eat literal food, has become just another exhausting task jammed into our increasingly inhuman schedules? Well, your spring can be a little more stress-free with Factor. Factor will provide you with delicious, never frozen, ready to eat gourmet meals that are chef crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Each week, you get to choose from a menu of 35 options to create your perfect breakfast, lunch, or dinner with absolutely no prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. And Factor makes sure you get exactly what you want. You can tailor deliveries to your schedule and customize how many meals you want each and every week, and you can pause anytime. So just head to factormeals.com/AmericanHysteria50 and use code AmericanHysteria50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code AmericanHysteria50 at factormeals.com/AmericanHysteria50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Check out Factor today. And now, back to the show.
Part of the book I really loved is when you are speaking with a Bigfoot investigator, let's say, and he's telling you a story, and you suddenly feel like that pull of belief once you're three beers in. And I, at one point in my life, worked on a podcast called Euphemet with my friend Jim Perry. And part of that was going out and speaking with people who'd had paranormal experiences. And one of those people was a, you know, Bigfoot believer who really believed in the spiritual side of Bigfoot. And he was so it was like so clearly just deeply embedded in his heart. Like he would well up talking about this imagining, his imagining, or perhaps real, what do I know, experience of Bigfoot. And he was driving us out to kind of his place where he spent time, you know, trying to find Bigfoot. And he was like, just like drop all your shit and like just be here and see what you feel. And as soon as he said that, I mean, I felt, you know, I felt so much mysterious, you know, this mysterious feeling come over me. And so did Jim. And I don't know, I knew in my head, I was like, I know what this is. I know that this is the pull of belief. But even noticing that doesn't change the experience of believing. And I was curious how often you were being pulled into believing even just a little bit. Like, how often was that happening for you? And how did you process that?
Yeah, well, you touched on something that I think that I encountered a lot. I mean, but I, you know, one of the things I encountered again and again, it's really sort of took me by surprise, was Bigfooters' testimonies, people who would come up to me during expeditions or at festivals or conferences and tell me their own personal encounters with Bigfoot in a way that was hard to discount. Mm-hmm. I mean, a few people had, you know, tears in their eyes, or one fellow had, you know, kind of tears streaming down his face. And as he, you know, told me about his encounter, I could not suspect them of lying or being dishonest. You know, there was something mm-hmm. happened to them that was extremely moving and powerful. And I, yeah, it wasn't my place at all to like tell them that, oh, that they must have been mistaken or something like that. That was not, I had no agenda along those lines. I mean, the last thing I wanted to do was, as an outsider and as a journalist, you know, show up to these events and like wag my finger at people and sure. try to explain away their experiences. And so, yeah, I found that like a very moving and fascinating part of my research. And I originally wanted to include all of these, the ones that I recorded in an appendix, and it ended up being, I think, too much. But I do have several, I think 4 or 5 fairly lengthy, almost verbatim, like transcriptions essentially of encounters in my book. And at no time, with maybe one exception, at no time did I think anyone was screwing with me. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that as you said, the power of those experiences, whether or not they're kind of quote unquote true, that's hard to account for. Mm-hmm. This is maybe getting a little bit off on a tangent, but I think probably people do need to believe in, like, science and reason and rationality doesn't answer everything. It doesn't account for everything. It doesn't seem to fill space in everyone's lives that needs to be filled. And so I think you definitely have to be open, have to not lose all contact with the more enchanted view of the world. I think that's really important. For me personally, I didn't have, you know, I really didn't have any moments like that where I felt seduced by my experiences, by the darkness, by whatever might lurk in the shadows, by the kind of romance of it. I'd never had that sort of experience. I have had moments, certainly in the wild in this country, and I think anyone who spent any real time in American wilderness has these sorts of experiences where you see something, you hear something happens that you can't explain. I remember backcountry camping in Arches National Park once upon a time, and camping on this high kind of sandstone, Navajo sandstone, I think they call it, and hearing something sort of pad across my campsite in the middle of the night and sort of very quietly, very lightly brush against my tent. And it could have, you know, it was probably like a bobcat or something like that. Who knows? But it was just, it was weird. And I think a lot of people have those kinds of experiences that they can't explain away or want to impose a certain kind of narrative on. That was a huge element of my book, that sense of mystery, the sense of possibility in nature, and the needs of the mind and imagination, I think, are a big part of where Bigfoot comes from and why so many people believe in him today.
Would you tell us, kind of in that vein, a little bit about what you found in terms of Bigfoot's relationship to, like, our, as Americans, relationship to nature? I especially enjoyed your section about clear cutting in the 20s, and then also the Mount St. Helens explosion as two of the examples. But yeah, I'm just interested in, it feels like Bigfoot is intrinsically connected to our psychology around this thing called the American wilderness.
Yeah. So sort of three things. I mean, there are many, many things, but three main things that I landed on in my research, and both in the field and talking to people and in my reading, that help account for Bigfoot phenomena. Again, setting aside here as much as possible to extract people's actual experiences, you know, Bigfooters who claim to have a sighting and have had some sort of phenomenal experience. But I'm talking about in terms of explaining, you know, Bigfoot popping up in the Tampa suburbs or, a half an hour from Columbus, Ohio, which is a city of almost a million people, you know.
Yeah.
The desire to believe in the many thousands of sightings every year and so on. But, and one of those things is, as I claim in the book, and I think, you know, I got a little pushback on this, but I think it's a pretty valid concern, is just the total ravaging of our American ecology, of our American landscape. Mm. This country has been just completely ravaged and rampaged by the wrecking ball of progress. You know, I mean, there's not hardly a single pinprick in the map. If you were to spread out, the map of the United States, there are a couple little, tiny little dots here and there that haven't been clear cut. Like virtually everything, every square acre, all the old growth, almost all of it is gone. It's all been logged.
Yeah.
And not just once, but multiple times, you know. And, you know, there's trees here still. There's a few in the Pacific Northwest. There's a couple down south. There's a few here in the Northeast that are 1,000 years old, as far as we know, maybe even older. And, you know, the logging companies, with the machinery they have today, they cut them down in 20 minutes. And they're absolutely chomping at the bit to do so, you know, to turn them into floorboards, and so my contention in the book is that Bigfoot partly is born out of this grief of what has happened to our wilderness. A lot of this wilderness, by the way, is public wilderness. It is our land. Mount St. Helens is a public, was at the time of the eruption, and it's still public land that public tax dollars are subsidizing logging, mining, ranching, cattle, sheep ranching that happens inside American national parks, you know. And I think there's a kind of culture-wide grief and anger over this. And Bigfoot represents possibilities that might still exist. It says something positive about our wilderness. If a creature like that, by some accounts, a 700 to 800 pound mammal can exist in these landscapes, and maybe we haven't destroyed them quite so thoroughly. Maybe there's some hope for the American landscape.
Yeah, I definitely think that has to be a big part of it, for sure. This idea that there is enough space, there's enough untouched wilderness for something not only to hide in, but to be completely concealed by. And that's something I think we'd all like to actually get to feel inside of ourselves a little bit. I would love to be someone who is after Bigfoot, because it seems like it's got to feel similar to, like, I'm very into the study of urban legends and the idea of legend tripping, where, you know, there's a haunted bridge, or there's, you know, a chair you go sit in the graveyard for 10 seconds and you'll see hell or something like that. Like, it's the same feeling of getting out there and seeking something, but it's different. It's like a different than a spiritual seeking, because you are looking for something you can see or hear or feel. I was very into ghost hunting, as I mentioned, as a teenager, but it just, I think that feeling has to be something that propels people coming back, because, you know, it seems like a lot of fun. Do you feel like people are having fun with this, or did it feel like there was more of a serious quality to the research, or the field research that people were doing?
Oh, yeah. No, fun is a huge part of it. I mean, going out in the woods and looking for Bigfoot, yeah, it's a huge gas. Yeah, and I had a ton of fun reporting this. I mean, the people are, by and large, really cool and welcoming. And yeah, it's just, it just makes wilderness more thrilling. If you believe something is there besides raccoons or porcupines or whatever, you believe there's something to be seen that not everyone is seeing. Of course, that's the thrill of the chase. You know, the treasure hunt basically is really speaks to a very deep part of American or just human psyches, I think, that just whatever strange yearning that we all kind of have of us in us for discovery, for revelation, like that's, yeah, it's definitely a huge part of it. And it's just, yeah, it's fun to be out there. Like a lot of Bigfooters have these little infrared, the FLIR infrared things. It's not a, yeah, it's a kind of camera, I suppose. And that some of them have actual infrared, night vision goggles rather. And, all these gadgets and doohickeys, walkie talkies, or communicate, these, triangulate and split up in groups. And it's just, yeah, it's funny. In a way, it's kind of like I say, I kind of compare it in my book, and it might sound like pejorative, but I don't mean it in that way. That's almost like wilderness LARPing, it's a, or like Quidditch or something. In a way, it has that element to it. But yeah, it's just fun. It's like a terrific idea to, in a lot of ways, most ways, it's a terrific idea to just entertain and to have fun with and just explore possibilities, and imagine what might be out there, both figure literally and figuratively. And I hope it comes across in the book. I had a lot of fun reporting this book, and a lot of these people I had a great time with. Some of them remain my friends. So,
No, it definitely comes across. I mean, it's a very funny book too. It is, I don't know, it's a romp. I'm going to call it a romp.
great.
More after this. And now back to the show. Yeah, so, along with the fun of being out in the woods, I got a sense, which I think is true with so many paranormal beliefs, of community, and that the community aspect is so important, but not just like the online message board community, but like a flesh and blood hang out in the woods. And that seems to be also a big part of the power.
Yeah, it's definitely community building. I mean, it's almost like fandom in a way, like sports fandom. And speaking from personal experience, like fandom could be a great community building, and this, especially in this day and age where we're sort of really alienated from one another. And, it's a, you can build relationships with people who you'd otherwise never come in contact with. And it's, but it can also be a terrible thing. Coming from Michigan, I'm used to almost a kind of masochism with sports fandom, and it can be, there's a dark side to it, but yeah, in terms of, so yeah, in the later chapter, I try to build this connection between white working class fortunes, which have really declined significantly in the past half century. This doesn't get talked enough about, but a connection between that and belief in things like Bigfoot. It's not limited to Bigfoot, obviously, and I'm making generalizations, but I think there is a, it's a kind of middle finger to sort of East Coast establishment. I mean, it's middle finger to a lot of things. It's to the a middle finger to the scientific establishment. It's to the media, to the sort of, privileged East Coast kind of insiders and East Coast aristocracy, and if you don't have a lot of money, like if you don't have stocks, like if you don't have money in the marketplace, which the vast majority of people do not have, chances are you're not doing very well.
Yeah.
You're probably struggling to pay your rent or your mortgage. You're probably struggling to send your kids to college. Maybe you can't send them to college. Maybe you live in fear of any kind of medical event that might bankrupt you because you're totally underinsured or uninsured. And like those are real, there's a lot of people out there who I met during my research who fall into that category, who happen to be Bigfoot believers, because it not just builds a sense of community and a sense of belonging, but is, I think, a kind of fuck you to established convention, established belief. Who are you to tell me what I should or should not believe in? Anyway, so those are the people I met in my book, by and large, not all of them, but by and large, white working class, middle class folks, largely white men. And I wanted to write about them. Wanted to write not just about where their beliefs come from, but where they come from. I think I said this earlier, but I wanted to try to build some sense of continuity between their beliefs and their backgrounds and how they kind of intersected today.
Yeah, and I think it's hard to ignore that our kind of Bigfoot craze did return around, I would say, 2016, right? When everything is changing, when the fantastical is entering politics in a way that it really has never before. And, you know, of course, you mentioned Pizzagate, you mentioned these conspiracy theories that we've talked about many times on the show. And I think that, I mean, as you mentioned, there's a giant overlap between the paranormal and conspiracy theory, especially on the right side of conspiracy theory. And I was wondering if you think that people come into conspiracy theories from Bigfoot, or if conspiracy theories bring them into Bigfoot, or like what the relationship is. Again, and I know you can't generalize, but what did you find on the road in terms of that overlap?
Yeah, I think it's probably both ways of thinking draw similar-minded people. I mean, I think maybe mm-hmm. Bigfoot in some instances could be seen as a sort of gateway drug to other kinds of paranormal and supernatural beliefs. And we know from gobs and gobs of research that there's a pretty clear connection between paranormal and supernatural beliefs and beliefs in conspiracy theories. But it's hard to say. I think I would probably err on the side of just saying that Bigfooters tend to be people who are open to ideas, right? They're open to mm-hmm. unorthodox ideas. And I think once you kind of open that door to Bigfoot and to Bigfoot-like phenomena, it's a very short road to conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't meet so many like wacko conspiracy theorists. I met a couple, you know, but mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that the people in my book, I certainly wouldn't say are like January 6th people or, you sure. know, Pizzagate people. Definitely not. I mean, that's one of the more marginal elements of the culture.
Right.
One of the sort of ways in which the animating beliefs of Bigfoot can really lead you astray. I mean, you know, I remember calling my wife from the parking lot of this camping ground that I was at in Kentucky for one of my expeditions and saying to her, there were like 30 of us kind of hanging out at this expedition. And I was just calling a check-in and saying, you know, like 80% of this is like perfectly just good, wholesome fun. Just like mm-hmm. guys hanging out, guys that might be like in a duck blind or on a trout stream or whatever, just yeah. hanging out, having a weekend around the campfire, doing some cool shit in the woods, you know, but there's this other element, 20% or something, that starts to lead down this kind of darker path. Once you open this door of, well, what could it have been? Well, then it could have been almost anything. Like nothing explains it. Nothing and everything will be the answer to that question. And there's a real kind of dangerous and dark rabbit hole to tumble down once you begin. But I think, again, just to reiterate, I think probably the majority of Bigfooters are not in that camp, but
yeah, I think that makes total sense. And someone that in your book that I think was my favorite subject that you spent time with was a man named Robert Pyle, who mm-hmm. wrote a book called Where Bigfoot Walks, Crossing the Dark Divide. And he was just such a fascinating person who was so well-spoken. And it seemed like you both had a very interesting journey talking to each other. And, you know, by the end of your conversation, this person who is so balanced in their interest in Bigfoot really does end up feeling that Bigfoot is real. So I wanted to hear a little bit about what it was like to hang out with Robert and, you know, kind of the things that he talked about so that our audience can hear them.
Yeah. So Bob Pyle is, Bob is mostly a poet and a writer, a prose writer, and also a novelist.
Oh, I could tell. Just a beautiful speaker. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's a brilliant guy, and he's written a great book about Bigfooting. He was also kind of a touchstone, a literary touchstone for me when I began my research. And I talked to him really early on a couple of times, and then also went and visited him when I was in Washington. And Bob was a great model early on, especially in just trying to keep an open mind, you know, and not foreclose on Bigfooters' ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, one of the hardest things to do, if I think if you, not just if you're an outsider, but you're a journalist, so you're skeptical, your hopefully foundation is oriented in reason and rationality and verifiable truth, verifiable fact or whatever. And so one of the hardest things I had early on was just like trying really hard to not let my own ideas intrude and trying to stay out of the lens and just narrate the experience I was having, without getting in the way. Again, I didn't want to like parachute in from Cambridge and like cast my, appraising eye around and every couple of paragraphs or every few pages insert my own assessment of things. I just did not, and tone and like the tenor of things was really important. And I really struggled with that early on. And Bob sort of, first of all, he sort of talked me out of a state of panic I was really early on where I just wasn't sure if I could do it. But also he just convinced me that it was okay to just let the narrative exist as it is and not insert myself too often. I mean, I think my ideas and my own beliefs are in there. I think readers can intuit them eventually. But he just encouraged me to, as much as is possible, and some of my research, I think, led me to believe that's not really possible to keep an open mind. We've sort of, at best, our minds are like just slightly ajar. One of our, unfortunately, cognitive biases really impede in our, well, to state the obvious, in our cognition, our ability to accept kind of new ideas and new phenomena. And but I tried, and more importantly, I tried to let Bigfooters tell their story without me getting in the way.
Sure.
And so that was, that was really important. And also just to meet a writer who was as accomplished and as smart and as big-hearted as Bob is, to know that he had done this and gone through all this, like, way before I did, was really energizing, especially in the early stages.
And he goes on to say, I believe that he is 85% sure that he believes that Bigfoot exists.
Yeah. And it's funny that I did. That is not like what that's not the sense you come away with from his book, I don't think. But he softened that somewhat in recent years. And, he like Matheson, he's a sane, sober guy and not credulous. He's just he's softened his beliefs for reasons that I get into in the book.
I loved hearing that he softened his beliefs, and I don't know, making this show, maybe you can relate to this, like my show here is a lot about like not debunking because that's not interesting to me, but reassessing what may or may not be true from the myths and the stories that we tell. And I think doing the show has had a dampening effect on some of the fun side of believing and what beliefs can do in the positive. Sure, yes, they can lead us to conspiracy theories and they can lead us to dark places. But at the same time, I think that without them, life is a lot harder. And I understand why. I used to believe in so many things that may be irrational now that I look back on and cringe a little bit, but I do remember how it felt to believe in something that I couldn't see. Like it was kind of an unparalleled feeling. And I just wanted to read a quote of yours back to you, which I'm sure is your favorite thing. But I just feel like this is a note I'd love to end on because I really, really like this. But you said, what I'd experienced was the intoxicating power of belief, a power that's in all of us. At the same time, one need not be kissed before falling in love. Bigfoot may or may not be real, I thought, but either way, there's something profoundly true about the feelings it evinced. And yeah, I just thought that was just almost, for me, the thesis that I came away with. And I am interested in what your relationship to belief became when this book was kind of all said and done. What did you come away with?
Yeah, there was a lot that surprised me.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I didn't think I was, now that I say it out loud, it sounds kind of stupid, but I didn't think I was going to be writing so much about belief. That's a lot of what this book is about, and it took me a while to realize that.
Mm-hmm.
The subtitle for a while, even was suggested by my editor, was something along the lines of why we believe in the unbelievable. And of course, I was like, well, that's, it's, you know, I can't remember what I said. I was like, that's ridiculous. But of course, that's exactly, she's exactly right. That's sort of what the book is about. And I will say that, you know, I think we absolutely, and I think this becomes pretty clear, is that I think we must try as much as we can to be governed by logic and by reason, by rationality. It's absolutely imperative, especially today, that that is foremost, the foremost impulse in our sort of public and private lives. But again, I think it's totally valid, and I think it's maybe even necessary simultaneously to not lose all contact with the more enchanted view of the world, to the view of what might be possible. That might be just sort of mystical or quote-unquote spiritual. It might be something that's just merely mysterious and unknown or unknowable. But I do think that it's possible to do both, to be both totally reasonable and rational and have a kind of spiritual investment in the world and in your own life and your own survival and in other people's and in our, in a, both in political life and in our public life more broadly. I think it's possible to do both and to be reasonable and kind of spiritual at the same time, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it makes lots of sense. I think that's the dream for me. That's where I'm hoping to get to. Well, is there anything else that you want to talk about that we didn't get to?
I will just say that I'm thinking of this because it's what you said earlier made me think of it. You were talking about, you know, this kind of intersection of belief and unbelief and not necessarily trying to disprove things, but just be open to both possibilities, but also a kind of investigation of what those possibilities might mean. And I guess I'm sort of just giving a shout out here to one of the groups of folks that I hung out with during the research of this book is guys out in Northern California that call themselves the Bluff Creek Project. And readers will read about this if they buy the book, that they are basically trying to cinematically recreate the Patterson-Gimlin film at the actual Bluff Creek, where it was filmed in 1967 by Roger Patterson and Bob Gimlin. This gave us, if your listeners aren't aware, one of the most famous and probably the most controversial piece of Bigfoot evidence in existence, which is this grainy footage of a purported female Bigfoot crossing the riverbed at Bluff Creek. And even if you don't know it by name, you have almost certainly seen the footage at some point in your life. And also it's the footage that gave us our kind of iconic profile of Bigfoot in stride, that the profile you see virtually everywhere in cartoon form on bumper stickers and water bottles and beer cans and so on. But they are essentially trying to recreate that film using the same film equipment and techniques that were used in the 1960s. And their intent isn't necessarily to prove or disprove Bigfoot, but just to try to determine the veracity of the film itself and whether or not it could possibly have been made in the way that the filmmakers claim it was. So it's really interesting. It's really it's far more intentional and sort of project driven than a lot of Bigfoot expeditions I went on. These guys were kind enough to invite me, and I don't think they're necessarily open to outsiders usually, unlike other Bigfoot expeditions. But that was a really cool part of the whole experience and really gave me a kind of, I don't know, hope, like faith in humanity, hope in humanity or something. That I don't know, it might sound kind of contrived, but I just really liked hanging out with them, and what they were doing was so interesting. And they weren't diehard believers. They weren't diehard skeptics. They were just interested in the art, this piece of art and this very important pop cultural object that had been sort of shot and cataloged, but more or less put on the shelf, and it deserves to be investigated, I think, just like Bigfoot itself. And these guys were also instrumental in I mentioned this just as a sidebar. Bigfoot is, besides Bigfooting, are up to a lot of other things, some of it doing some good in the world. And these guys have all these trail cameras set up around Bluff Creek that they've been taking footage for years now there. And you know, with the possibility of capturing maybe footage of a Bigfoot, which they haven't done, obviously, but what they have captured footage of is a creature called the Humboldt Marten, which was thought to be extinct. And they've captured so many images of it, they were able that it helped get the Humboldt Marten relisted as an endangered species in Northern California, which I thought was just an additionally cool sort of sidebar to the work that they were doing there. So I just wanted to mention those guys in case your listeners hadn't heard of them, and they should look into what they're up to, because it's they're really cool and it's really interesting what they're doing.
Yeah, that's, it feels like one of the most ideal ways to look into Bigfoot for me. That seems like it'd be so fun to just focus on. And I like that you called it a piece of art, because it does, you know, though it has not been officially, I don't think, debunked or whatever you want to say, it does exist as this like piece of Americana that is like soaked into all of our consciousness. And I just feel like that was a very fun part of your book. So yeah, I recommend your book very highly for anyone who is interested in Bigfoot, duh. But also, I mean, you know, you bring in so many interesting writers. You know, Thomas Merton has a big section, which I loved. And yeah, I just think it's a book not necessarily for people who are interested in Bigfoot, but for people that are interested in the psychology and philosophy, even of just America itself. And yeah, I loved your book. So thank you so much for being here and talking to us.
No, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. It's been great talking to you.
This was American Hysteria. Make sure you check out John O'Connor's beautiful book, The Secret History of Bigfoot. You can find a link in our show notes. If you want to get more of our show, you can head to patreon.com/American Hysteria or subscribe on Apple Plus. You'll get ad-free episodes as well as bonus content, including our subscribers-only podcast, Hysteria Home Companion, in which producer Miranda and I tell you stories that were left out of episodes, as well as stories we just think that you would really like. So head to patreon.com/American Hysteria or subscribe on Apple Plus. You can also find more fun stuff on our Instagram at American Hysteria Podcast. In addition to that, you can get our merch at AmericanHysteria.com. And while you're there, you could leave us a message on our Urban Legends hotline about a tale that you remember from growing up that you would like us to investigate. That's AmericanHysteria.com. Our producer and editor is Miranda Zickler, and I'm your host, Chelsea Weber Smith. Thanks, as always, for listening, and I hope you have a great week.